A viral craze exposes the dangers of binge drinking.
This, you know, Borg trend seems to be uniquely dangerous to the brain, especially in young people.
What is Borg, and why is it putting teens in the hospital? That's coming up on WGLT's news magazine, Sound Ideas. Good afternoon. I'm Lauren Warnicke, in for John Norton. On today's show, a Bloomington concert pays tribute to the three Bs, not Bach, Beethoven, or Brahms.
We think of those composers as some of the best, but let's think about all the composers who get put off to the side.
Plus, Heartland Theater chooses from more than 600 submissions for one of its annual staples.
The 10-Minute Play Festival is a great gateway for new and emerging artists.
All that after a Bloomington Normal news update. This is WGLT's Sound Ideas on 89.1 FM and WGLT.org, part of the NPR network.
Support for WGLT comes from Bloomington Normal Audiology. Here My Story continues with local patients Ralph and Carol Weisheit.
Boy, what I remember at the moment that I had my hearing aids in was just the clarity, and some of the background noises that I'd been hearing before were gone.
Ralph and Carol's full story can be found at bnaudiology.com.
From the campus of Illinois State University in Normal, this is WGLT's news magazine Sound Ideas. I'm Lauren Warnicke, in for John Norton. A new type of binge drinking is gaining traction among college students by way of viral TikTok videos, and it can be very risky. BORG stands for Blackout Rage Gallon, and it consists of a mixture of large quantities of alcohol, water, sweet flavoring, and hangover remedies like Pedialyte. Dr. Deepak Nair is a critical care neurologist with OSF Healthcare. In this edition of Sound Health, Nair tells Joe Deacon from sister station WCBU about the dangers of Borg drinking and the long-term effects of alcohol abuse.
In the larger context of just alcohol consumption, this Borg drinking, aka blackout rage gallon, seems to be a unique form of binge drinking. And binge drinking, just in the societal level, seems to be somewhat unique to the United States of America. So binge drinking is more tightly correlated with the adverse and toxic effects of alcohol by itself. It's also more associated with alcoholism compared to people who are sort of spacing out their alcohol consumption. And it also seems to be more tightly correlated with the neurotoxic effects. So, you know, when you think about it from that sort of big picture view, this, you know, Borg trend seems to be uniquely dangerous to the brain, especially in young people.
So if you could kind of explain it, they're trying to dilute the large amount of alcohol. Is that how it works?
Yeah. So the idea is you take an empty, milk jug, a gallon of milk, empty it out, and you fill it with alcohol of choice, and often up to, you know, a 750 ml size bottle of something like vodka or what have you. And then you fill up the rest with some sort of flavored water, right, to sort of mask the alcohol. But I'm assuming that the notion here is, well, you're diluting it with water, but if you're consuming that entire, you know, volume of fluid, you're still getting all that alcohol, and the dilution with water there doesn't really matter. What matters here is the total amount of alcohol that's being consumed. And so it would be no different than if you just drank that bottle of alcohol by itself.
So what are the biggest dangers of this particular type of binging then? Is it's more dangerous than common binge drinking?
That's hard to say. Certainly the sheer volume of alcohol would be uniquely dangerous, right? So, you know, here in the U.S., we define binge drinking as, I think it's something like more than four standard, you know, drinks within, I think, less than a two-hour period. But here you're talking about an entire bottle's worth of alcohol. That would be, you know, several times that, right? So the sheer volume of alcohol here is uniquely risky just because it's a lot.
This Borg craze seems to kind of had gained momentum through social media. Have we seen any sort of spike in binge drinking here in the Peoria area in recent years?
You know, from my clinical experience, I can't say. I mean, certainly we see that fairly regularly, and it does seem to be somewhat seasonal. So Peoria being a college town, for example, at the start of the school year is always a pretty common trend, but then also towards the end of the school year when people are celebrating. I don't know that I have data on hand to say that that's necessarily been true this past year. But I mean, given the recency of this, we just may not be seeing it yet.
You mentioned that binge drinking seems to be a particularly American cultural phenomenon. Why do you think that is? What makes it so risky and but yet so common?
So I think a lot of this just has to do with our sort of cultural take on alcohol in general, right? So, I mean, we certainly don't want our kids being exposed to alcohol early on. But, you know, when we're overly strict in saying that, you know, you really shouldn't touch it and we mystify it, you know, like my kids have seen me enjoy a cocktail with my friends and such. So I think part of it is this notion that it's okay for us but not okay for you kind of creates this mystery and it creates that interest. Obviously, there's going to be a million factors here, and I'd hate to give an overly simple answer, but I think that's got to be a huge part of it.
Is binge drinking or drinking an extreme amount in a short period, is it more dangerous, less dangerous?
Good question. So binge drinking is uniquely more dangerous than even if you consume the same amount of alcohol over a longer, if you had the same number of drinks in one day versus over a week, for example. That's going to be more injurious to the brain. I think for a couple of obvious reasons. One is that you're exposing the brain to a higher dose of alcohol over a shortened period of time. So you're more likely to achieve toxic levels in that experience. Whereas if you spread that out over several days, for example, then you're never really meeting that critical threshold.
You touched on it a bit already, but what are the severe long-term risks to particularly binge drinking?
So over time, chronic exposure to high doses of alcohol will actually shrink the brain because you're actually losing brain cells as a result of that toxic effect. There are several clinical syndromes that are also associated with alcohol use. So the generic term we would use is encephalopathy or alcoholic encephalopathy. And encephalopathy is just a Greek term that literally means sick brain. So you're just having some impairment in brain function. Over time, though, that can become permanent. And one of the main functions of the brain that can get impacted is memory.
That's OSF neurologist Dr. Deepak Nair talking to Joe Deacon from sister station WCBU about the dangers of Borg binge drinking.
Support for WGLT health coverage comes from Carle Health. You can count on Carle as your partner in healthcare. Information at carle.org.
Coming up next week on Sound Ideas, the people and the memories of World War II may be fading, but for some of the remaining survivors, they are as real as ever. Next week on the 79th anniversary of D-Day, WGLT's Lindsay Jones talks to a woman who fled Nazi oppression and was rescued by American soldiers. Lena Dooring of Normal has been profoundly allegiant to the U.S. ever since.
I walked over there and I says, I want to talk to you people. You don't know what you have. I says, I'm a child of World War II. I can tell you horror stories. Appreciate your country and love it.
That's next week, right here on Sound Ideas.
On this week's Wait, Wait, actor and director Regina King explains her lifelong crush on Sam Elliott in the movie Roadhouse.
Just something about when he has that rubber band in his mouth and he's pulling his hair back and he's about to whoop them. It was just sexy to this little girl.
I'm Peter Sagal. It's a delightfully confessional new quiz this week. Join us for an all-star Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me from NPR.
Listen Saturday morning at 10, Sunday at noon on WGLT.
The Baroque Artists of Champaign-Urbana perform Saturday at Illinois Wesleyan University with a program called The Three B's. By name, the choral group has a focus on old music, really old. But as director Sarah Riskind says, her vision is bigger than Baroque.
My goal has been to keep the foundation of Baroque music for the ensemble, but to use that as a jumping off point. The Three B's is a program that intentionally challenges our idea of which composers become known as the great masters. So the Three B's colloquially represents the Bach, Beethoven, and Brahms. And so we think of those composers as some of the best. But let's think about all the composers who get put off to the side. Now, there are lots of old dead white male composers who
Who are also put off to the side.
Put off the side with that definition, but maybe are still programmed a whole lot because of their position in the canon.
Right.
But then you have the composers that I'm programming in this concert, and I'm not saying we shouldn't do Bach, Beethoven, and Brahms. I love those composers. They're wonderful. But here we have Lili Boulanger, was an early 20th century composer. And then we have Harry T. Burley, who is a black man, and he is best known for his relationship with Dvorak, teaching Dvorak, his teacher, the spiritual melodies that he learned from his grandfather. And then Dvorak was inspired by that to create the famous Largo melody from the New World Symphony.
Mm-hmm.
And then the third composer is Margaret Bonds.
I want to focus first on Margaret Bonds. Yes, mid-century composer. I was astonished to read about her educational background at Northwestern University. You know, Northwestern is revered for its music school. I believe she was one of the first, if not the first, black women to gain acceptance into the music program and was allowed to study but not allowed to live on campus. Just talk more about that thread that you're pulling about elevating these composers who, for structural societal reasons, have not been revered as much as some of their contemporaries.
Composers like Margaret Bonds maybe achieved some status during their lifetime. She did have some major performances and performances by really esteemed singers such as Marian Anderson. However, I would say even based on my own experiences in the choral world, until recently, most conductors have studied, you know, what we considered the greats, which were mainly white men, particularly from, you know, the Baroque, classical, romantic periods specifically. And the fact is, it just takes a lot more effort and a lot more research to find other music that is also very high quality, but may not have been performed and may not be in our textbooks and may not be in our graduate programs.
So in academic circles and in, you know, niche choral music society, where these works are starting to get more of the recognition they deserve, how do you square that with the adoring public of Central Illinois that may take longer to warm, right? They haven't yet had that education. And so in programming your three Bs, they might feel like they're taking a risk. Not a risk in terms of trying female and black composers per se, but in not having that recognizability that has been ingrained in the public about classical music.
I think we really need to tell the story to the public, and we'll also be sharing the bios of our really amazing soloists. We have Dr. Ollie Watts Davis from University of Illinois. She's a vocal music professor and very highly regarded. We also have Dr. Philip Phillips, who's a physics professor at University of Illinois and who's a wonderful bass. So we can draw people in with those things, and I'm very proud of the catchy title, The Three Bs. I think brings in a lot of curiosity about the music.
Maybe Bach and Tchaikovsky and Beethoven and Mozart get people in the door, but then what do you do with them once they're in it? Music programmers are doing a better job having your programming not be centered on old white dead guys and then with one specialty program that has women, right? But that women and people of color need to be infused throughout your whole season.
It's really, really important to me that it's a consistent element of my programming. Each specific concert program should have a certain, you know, amount of diversity in it, not just so that I can say that I did that, but so that we hear these amazing voices and the amazing music that has come from all sorts of people. For example, next season, I'm planning to do some early Jewish music, Jewish Baroque music, affiliated with the Amsterdam Jewish community. And so that brings us a different kind of diversity. And again, not just so that I can check boxes, but because it's really interesting and it's valuable. We learn so much from these stories.
Did I miss anything, Sarah?
I just wanted to mention a little bit more about the Burley piece. Burley's Five Songs of Lawrence Hope. It's an art song cycle, and Burley was really successful with his spiritual arrangements, but he really wanted his art songs to become better known by the public. And this particular cycle, it says of Lawrence Hope, but Lawrence Hope was actually a pen name for a woman poet named Adela Florence Corey Nicholson. And so I just love that particular song cycle. It has extremely stunning harmonies and melodies as well. And the text is very sensual love poetry. So it's a very different text than the social justice focused text of the Du Bois Credo that the Bonds sets.
That was Sarah Riskind of the Baroque Artists of Champaign-Urbana. The Three Bs, music by Bonds, Burley, and Boulanger, takes place at 7:30 p.m. tomorrow in Westbrook Auditorium at Illinois Wesleyan University.
Support for arts and culture programming on WGLT comes from PNC Financial Services. We're focusing on giving back as part of an ongoing commitment to the community PNC serves.
Stories and conversations from around Bloomington Normal. We'll end today with Heartland Theater's 10-Minute Play Festival, which you might think is easy compared to the full-scale, evening-length productions they put on throughout each year. But here's Heartland Artistic Director Reese Lovell. He says to think again.
There's extensive planning that begins months in advance. It's a contest that we hold for playwrights. They could submit plays to us as long as they adhere to the following criteria. They got to be 10 minutes. They can't have more than four characters. And they must stick to the theme. This year's theme is the waiting room.
I was looking back through our archives a little bit and came across a conversation you had with Laura Kennedy in 2018, in which there was a very impressive, you know, passing the 300 mark of submissions. Well, this year, you've more than doubled that.
Yes.
And there's been a pandemic in between. So it's unfathomable, actually, to go through 650 10-minute place.
Yeah, we've got two levels of readers, and you're right, 650 plays, even at 10 minutes, you do the math on that.
That's a lot of minutes.
That's a lot of minutes, yeah. So we have two levels of readers, kind of a first tier, second tier. The first tier readers read every one of them. They narrow it down to 40 50 plays that they think have merit. Those are then our semifinalists. They get passed along to the second tier committee, of which I'm a part, and then we make the selection of the winning eight plays. So every year we start with whatever number, and it comes down to eight 10-minute plays that are presented as one evening of theater. So we do four plays, take an intermission, and do another four.
And with no shade to you or us in Bloomington Normal, I mean, how does that many people know about this?
when you're around for 20 years and when you've got a managing director as good as Gail Dobbins, word gets out. For example, we have a winning playwright from Skokie this year. He's going to come down to see his play. And it's as a writer myself, it's a great treat, you know, because your manuscript is like your baby, you know. And once you finish writing it and put it out into the world, you just kind of hold your breath and say, take good care of my kid, you know, treat it right, raise it.
Yeah. And I think it just shows the appetite for new works, right? And the
Absolutely.
And the desire of theater artists and practitioners to have new material.
Yeah, and the 10-Minute Play Festival is a great gateway for new and emerging artists, certainly for the playwrights themselves. A lot of these playwrights, it's the first time they've written anything. But there's also a ton who have, they do this for a living. You know, they're constantly writing. But every play's got to start somewhere.
Right. So do some of these 10-minute nuggets eventually kind of manifest as longer full-length plays?
Yes, they do, in fact. We've had quite a few plays that have gone on to be published in 10-minute play anthologies, things of that sort. And some of them, you know, the writers, especially the ones that come and see them on their feet, they can get a much better idea of what works, what doesn't work, and they'll go back to the drawing board. They'll make edits, and sometimes those 10-minute plays turn into full-length plays. It's really gratifying.
Let's talk a little bit more about that theme, the waiting room. I think the most obvious thing that my mind gravitates towards is like a hospital, right? And mm-hmm. the anticipation of the various reasons why people might be in a waiting room at a hospital.
Yes.
But then I thought there's also like the train station. There's maybe, I don't know, some reference to purgatory.
Uh-huh.
Who knows? So talk a little bit through some of the takes on the theme in terms of what we're going to see at the festival.
We ended up with a nice mix. There's one that's set in a police station, kind of a lobby. There's one, you mentioned purgatory. There is one.
That the ultimate happens. Waiting room. Right?
Yeah, the ultimate waiting room. There's also a really nice mix of comedy and drama.
Yeah.
You know, that's one of the things that our readers pay a lot of attention to, because you don't want a whole evening of really kind of serious Greek tragedy, you know,
right.
doom and gloom, nor do you want, you know, farce the whole time.
The 2023 10-Minute Play Festival runs 3 weekends starting tonight at Heartland Theater in Normal. Thanks for choosing WGLT's Sound Ideas, made possible in part by Bloomington Normal Audiology. I'm Lauren Warnicki. Story help today also came from Joe Deacon of our sister station WCBU. The show was produced by Samantha Hill. This is 89.1 FM, WGLT and WGLT.org, part of the NPR network.